Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
So we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but don't you
know? Yes, indeed, we started to burn many things we found. That's wonderful. Fabulous. Dora Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Solartopia song on the Tomorrow's Children album from Rivertown Kids. We have a great show today. Three of my very, very close friends are going to be joining us to talk about nuclear power. This is the second anniversary of the catastrophe at Fukushima. Before we jump into it, I want to mention that I've posted a piece, which is at Common Dreams Counterpunch, nukefree.org, my home site, nukefree.org, freepress.org, and a few others, sparked by, inspired by, and depressed by the reality of a study that's come out now from Fukushima. It's actually the 10th study of children conducted by the prefectural government of Fukushima in Japan. They've actually surveyed over 300,000 people. This particular sample on this study is about 95,000 children. And of the 95,000 children, this is not a small sample, folks, of the 95,000 children they've surveyed, they have found 44% with thyroid abnormalities. This is children growing up, living in the vicinity of Fukushima, 44% thyroid abnormalities, and this is just after 2 years. Now, we would expect this. It's totally predictable. There's indisputable science. Somebody want to confront you with this from the nuclear industry and say, oh, it's, you know, just more scaremongering, blah, blah, blah. Any scientist who knows anything about atomic radiation will tell you that this is a completely predictable outcome from the Fukushima accident. Iodine-131 comes from pretty much every fission emission, all the fallout from fission, from nuclear power to nuclear weapons. Iodine-131 is a mainstay. It came out at Three Mile Island, certainly at Chernobyl, now at Fukushima. Unmeasured, by the way, there is no credible estimate of how much iodine-131 was released at Fukushima, but we know it was huge quantities. It had to be huge quantities. We had three explosions and meltdowns at Fukushima 2 years ago today, and blanketing the region, obviously, with iodine-131. At this point in time, a sample of 95 or so thousand children has shown a 44% rate of thyroid abnormalities. We're talking at least 35 to 40,000 children who are known today to have thyroid abnormalities. Thyroid abnormalities in a child will result in, can result, and is likely to result, in many cases virtually certain to result, in developmental abnormalities, both mental and physical. And, you know, this is, it's a catastrophe. It's an apocalyptic event. It's a Holocaust. Call it what you will. There are between 35,000 and 40,000 children we know for absolute certainty today were harmed in their thyroids. And that's just one part of the body by radioactive emissions from Fukushima. There is zero chance that this came from anything else. These are abnormalities that are not normally seen. This is a sample close to 100,000 children, this does not happen. You take 100,000 children from places around the world that are not Fukushima, you will find that these thyroid abnormalities will exist in tiny, tiny numbers. This is 40,000 children already affected by the fallout from this catastrophe 2 years ago today. So on that cheery note, I want to introduce three of my really good friends. Deb Katz, are you there? Hi, Deb. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Good. You're going to be with us for about a half hour, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, great. Dan Keller. Dan, you there?
Here.
Dan, good to talk to you from Wendell, Massachusetts. Anna Georgie?
Yeah.
Okay,
hello.
Wonderful. You two are going to be with us for the full hour. Thank you so much. I have calculated that between the four of us, Deborah Katz, active with the Citizens Awareness Network, Dan Keller, active in anti-nuclear, and with Anna Georgie at Montague in Western Massachusetts from the early 1970s, between the four of us, we have about 160 years of activism against nuclear power. And, of course, this is a significant event today that we want to talk about, but also what's going on. Very briefly, Deb Katz is active very strongly. The Citizens Awareness America's Network is one of the leading organizations fighting to shut down at long, long last the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant. Was active in the successful campaign to shut Yankee Row, which went down in early 1990s. Dan Keller is the filmmaker responsible for the award-winning Lovejoy's Nuclear War and The Last Resort, two truly great and very, very important, very influential documentary films about the struggle against nuclear power. And Anna Georgie is the author of No Nukes, published by South End Press back in the 1970s. We would call it the germinal book, source book for the early anti-nuclear movement, providing us tremendous, information, resources, and all that on, fighting nuclear power. Anna, is that book still available, still in print?
I think it is, and it's online if you can find it, and it on Amazon in used copies, well used copies. But I just want to say 52 people worked on that. It was a labor of love, and a lot of people put into it.
Yes, and Dan Keller, your movies, Lovejoy's Nuclear War and The Last Resort, along with others, are still available at GreenMountainPostFilms.com. Is that right? GMPFilms.com?
That's right, and we have a whole string of other nuclear-related films available there, too.
Great, GMPfilms.com. Do you give out the phone number?
You can call us at area code 413-863-4754, and there's always somebody there to answer your call.
Okay, and we will talk to you after we talk with Deb for a while. We will come to you, Dan, and talk especially about the tower toppling that occurred 39 years ago at Montague that inspired the Lovejoy's Nuclear War film. It would be great to hear about that. But let's start with Deb. Deb Katz, you are one of the few women I know that when you walk into a room with utility executives, cardiac arrests occur. And tell us, if you will, what's going on now with Vermont Yankee and the campaigns to stop other nuclear plants in the Northeast here on this second anniversary of the Fukushima disaster.
Point that we're really at a tipping point for many reasons, and I'll sort of give a brief history only because many people don't know outside of Vermont or New England what's going on. CAN, with other groups, did a powerful organizing campaign to get legislation passed that empowered the Vermont legislature to decide whether the only nuke in Vermont would be allowed to continue to operate when its license expired in 2012. This is a separate process from what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission does, which is to say whether a reactor is safe enough, but the state has the power, all states have the power, to actually decide whether a reactor can operate within their borders on issues other than safety, like the environment, whether the corporation is a bad apple, whether they're doing a good job, whether you want a future which is sustainable rather than nuclear.
Yeah, and I love this.
The
legislature passed a bill that
empowered them, and in 2010 voted, in fact, to not allow Vermont Yankee to continue to operate past its license expiration in March 2012.
Right, and I wanted to, you said something that I wanted to jump in on. You briefly mentioned that the state is not allowed to intervene on safety issues. I love this. The Atomic Energy Act of 1957 has exempted the nuclear power industry from any local control based on safety issues. And so
right.
We've seen this ridiculous dance in the courts where the owners of Vermont Yankee, who promised way back when that they would shut the plant if the state voted to shut it, are now saying that the state has, people of Vermont have no right to make any pronouncements whatsoever having to do with safety. And they've gone in.
It goes even further, because you could say Vermont Yankee, which was owned by a consortium of corporations that was under the flagship of Northeast Utilities, was bought in 2002 by Entergy, which of course is a Louisiana corporation, a really bad apple. And they signed a contract then which codified not just what Vermont Yankee had agreed to under the old ownership, but in fact said they wouldn't continue to operate if they didn't get this license from the state. They would in fact begin decommissioning. And what's happened since they have not gotten a license is they haven't taken it very well. And they have sued the state, in fact, repeatedly over one issue after another, claiming that what the state is actually trying to do, and this is where safety comes up, that the state is really trying to deal with safety issues through the back door.
Isn't that amazing? Here we have to sneak around and pretend that we're not talking about safety. For God's sake,
I don't think we're sneaking around. I think that's what's really important to take in. I mean, I could even make an argument why safety should be left up to the NRC to some extent. There aren't a lot of experts that the state has to determine if Entergy is doing an adequate job in terms of safety, except when everything breaks down as it has there, and then you question it. But the technical expertise that's needed and the people the state would have to hire to figure this out is not so easy. But there really are grounds on which the state of Vermont stands strongly in terms of rejecting Entergy and Vermont Yankee. This
yeah.
is now in the court system, and it was in district court first, in which Entergy was able, through cherry-picking the record of the legislature, to get the judge to go along with them. But, in fact, in going along with them, the judge said, well, there is a state process to get a license, and you need to go through that. And Entergy said, we want to go through it, so that there's the appellate court battle that's going on at this point, because the state appealed the district court ruling and, in fact, will likely win or get a split decision there. And then it went back to what's called the Public Service Board, which is a judicial arm of the legislature, to decide whether it can get a state license. Now, Entergy wanted to go there. It was what it wanted to do. And now that it looks like the Public Service Board is going to rule against them, now they're claiming that the Public Service Board has no power in this situation. And they went to the state Supreme Court and said, look, we don't want the state judiciary looking at this. We want the Vermont Supreme Court to issue us a certificate of public good. So whenever Entergy gets turned down for whatever it wants, it just begins to shred the document more and more. It signed in 2002 to get its way.
So here we are,
Deb Katz.
We're talking about
trouble at this point. UBS, which is a Swiss financial firm, has come out and said that Vermont Yankee, as well as Fitzpatrick in New York and Ginna in New York, are lost leaders, and that Entergy has the potential to be in trouble, that its nuclear fleet, especially the tin can nukes it bought you know, with all of the deregulation debacle that took place in the 90s, that their nuclear fleet is bringing them down. Of course, it's also being brought down because of gas prices and the issues of fracking and all the amount of gas that's coming through the pipeline at this point, which is, in fact, taking out both coal plants and nuclear plants because they can't produce power as cheaply, and they can't get long-term power contracts. And
okay, so,
Vermont Yankee doesn't have a long-term power contract.
So, Deb Katz, we're looking at the big picture here, Deb Katz from the Citizens Awareness Network. We're also with Dan Keller, a filmmaker, and Anna Georgie. Anna will talk to us later in the show about the transition that's actually tangibly going on in the world's fourth largest economy in Germany, from nuclear and from fossil fuels to solartopian, solar, wind, tidal, geothermal, ocean thermal, biofuels, and increased efficiency. But, Deb, while we're talking about this, Deb Katz, the bigger picture is this. There are 104 commercial reactors left operating in the United States today. When we first started, the four of us and so many others fighting reactors, Richard Nixon said there'd be 1,000.
Hmm.
So based on the success of the No Nukes movement, we can say that about 900 reactors or so did not get built. Now, in the United States today, the 104, two are definitely going to shut this year. That's a given. Kewaunee in Wisconsin, as you mentioned, Deb, the low prices for natural gas brought on by fracking have undercut even these older commercial reactors, which have licenses and are amortized and the whole deal, which should be cash cows. They're actually in deep enough financial trouble to prompt the shutting of one, and the other, Crystal River in Florida. I mean, this is an unbelievable story. The Crystal River is an old reactor, and there were some problems with containment and so on. And so the owner, the utility that owns it, Progress Energy, decided they needed to do a fix, and they got some bids, and then they said, well, we can do it cheaper. And they went in, and they poked 2, 3, 4 holes in the containment dome and jacked it up to a $3 billion fix, and now they're going to shut that one. We also have
shut it because the other corporations, nuclear corporations, said, you know, all of them contribute to a fund, a kind of insurance fund, to help pay for repairs at nukes. And the other nuclear corporations said, we're not going to pay for Crystal River. You screwed up, and we're not going to make it right for you.
Right.
What's also important with Kewaunee is that, you know, they had gone through the whole process of getting relicensed by the NRC, but because they could not get a long-term power contract anywhere, they couldn't sell the nuke, and they couldn't keep it operating.
Right, and now we have two reactors in California.
The nuclear industry was putting up huge billboards just about saying, the renaissance is here, we're back, and we're back,
right,
and we're strong. And in fact, it was a fraud. It was a wet dream. And what you actually have is the colossal failure of nuclear power.
Right.
And the struggle to keep old nukes operating way past their lifetime to just keep the nuclear industry afloat.
Right, and it's basically like as if the Renaissance had just started in Venice in the 1500s, and suddenly the Black Plague swooped in and killed 90% of the population, which in fact happened. But we also have two reactors in California at San Onofre between L.A. and San Diego. This is another Keystone Cop story. The owning utilities, San Diego Gas and Electric and Southern California Edison, spent $700 million putting in four new steam generators, which they knew, as it turned out, were faulty. The documents have just emerged based on a letter forcing them public by Senator Barbara Boxer and soon-to-be Senator, we hope, Edward Markey of Massachusetts. And this letter evoked or forced public some documents that showed that the owning utilities knew that the steam generators being installed by Mitsubishi actually were likely to fail. And fail they did. These two reactors have been shut since January of last year, and Southern California Edison is now fighting to get Santa Rosa Unit 2 open at 70% power. And this is the argument they're making. I mean, I think it's wacky in Vermont. These guys are saying, well, we don't think this Unit 2 can operate at 100%, which is what it's licensed for. So we want to operate it at 70% and see what happens. On the second anniversary of an accident where three reactors exploded, for God's sakes, this utility wants to take a reactor to 70% and fool around, see if the thing's going to work. I mean, it's insane. Now, you've mentioned, Deb, and Dan Keller and Anna Georgie are standing by patiently and gracefully. We appreciate it. Let's deal with Vermont Yankee and Fitzpatrick in New York. The UBS, the financial advisors, have basically said that these reactors are now losing money.
They are losing money. They have, in fact, UBS has said to sell Entergy stock. There are 10 other financial instruments that have Entergy on hold, and only 4 are at buy at this point. And this is really significant because it is, in certain ways, with all the organizing, the work in the organizing is pushing them to the edge in one way or another, which is what we have worked to do since we got that vote, because we have gotten them to have to increase the amount of money that they give to the state just to operate from $3 million to $12 million. We have a green fielding bill this year in the legislature that we think will pass, which will cost them $40 million, and we keep pushing them to the economic limit where they have to say they can't do it anymore. But they are in a dangerous and precarious position because they don't want to yet pull the plug because they're afraid that there'll be a run on their stock.
Well, let's hope there is. I've certainly stole all my stock.
Well, they're going to have to cut bait soon, and the question is how soon. The only reactor that is making money for them in the Northeast in this whole debacle of buying Northeast nukes is Indian Point.
And Indian Point,
of course,
that's
what is subsidizing all the other reactors, which include Vermont Yankee, Fitzpatrick, and Pilgrim, because Pilgrim is also on the edge.
Now, Indian Point, of course, is being attacked hugely by a grassroots movement with actually we have the somewhat cooperation, not quite as unyielding as that coming from Peter Shumlin in Vermont, but Governor Andrew Cuomo has proclaimed himself a foe of Vermont, of New York, the New York reactors at Indian Point, and there are water issues there that we think could be used
shut those reactors. Well, they're using similar issues, which is where does the state have power and traction? Because, you know, when CAN decided to do a statewide issue in terms of closing Vermont Yankee, it was because we decided there was no satisfaction possible from the federal government, from the NRC. You could not get them to close a nuke. That the only way it would happen was on a states' rights issue. And in a certain way, it became much more fertile ground after 9/11. The tragedy in that situation actually provoked many governors in states to start petitioning the NRC to do something about the high-level waste that was stored in overcrowded pools. Because, you know, a National Governors Council actually said that these pools were basically, you know, non-deployed nuclear weapons at this point. And the government has done nothing about it. I mean, it's one of the things that happened at Fukushima, one of the most dangerous things that happened at Fukushima that is still not solved, which is the burning up of fuel in the number 4 reactor in that pool, in which the pool is still unstable. And they're trying to build a kind of steel wall to hold it up, because that is the most dangerous amount of radiation that can be given off, because it is the largest amount of radiation inventory anywhere in all those reactors.
Right.
And what does Fukushima have to understand? In that fuel pool, which has released all this cesium, is nothing compared to what's at Vermont Yankee. They had maybe 100 tons of waste, and Vermont Yankee has 630 tons of high-level waste sitting in a pool suspended 7 stories above ground with a tin roof on it.
Well, on that happy note, I want to turn to Dan Keller. I mean, the reality is, of course, at Fukushima that we have an unsolved situation there. We have a spent fuel pool flying in the air at Unit 4. Nobody knows what to do with it. We did have a 5.0 Richter scale earthquake near Fukushima today to celebrate the anniversary. God forbid a major earthquake could occur and bring down that fuel pool would be the worst release of radiation in human history, far exceeding what happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And in fact, Fukushima has already done that many times over. Deb Katz, it's wonderful to have you with us. I want to call now on Dan Keller. Dan, you there?
Still here.
Okay, so Dan Keller, you were present at Montague Farm in western Massachusetts in 1973 when the local utility company, Northeast Utilities, announced that it wanted to build twin nuclear reactors worth $1.35 billion 4 miles from an infamous communal farm. And a young man from that farm named Sam Lovejoy went over and knocked down on Washington's birthday of 1974 a weather tower that had been put up to test wind direction for this nuclear plant. And this amazing act prompted quite a bit of outcry, including a film made by you. Can you tell us about this this film, Lovejoy's Nuclear War, and what happened with it?
Well, the first time my friend Sam Lovejoy, who I had known for quite a few years, saw the 500-foot steel weather tower that was erected on the Montague Plains was when I was with him, bringing him back from the bus stop, I think, and we turned a corner in my car, and lo and behold, there was the tower standing up tall and blinking, and Sam blinked at it and said, well, you know, we're going to have to knock that thing down.
A whole lot of blinking going on there, yeah.
And lo and behold, he did eventually do that. And I was actually, as far as I know, aside from Sam, the only person to witness the actual falling of the tower, because I did give him a ride. I can now admit, having the statute of limitations gone by, that I gave Sam a ride to the tower and then drove up to a hill nearby and sat patiently waiting for, it must have been 2 or 3 hours, while he worked assiduously to loosen the turnbuckles on the tower.
Well, this is a major news scoop here on the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. the accomplice.
Well, I'm proud to admit it now.
Intimate.
And it was a wonderful experience to actually see the thing fall.
Oh, man.
Because
you didn't film it, though.
No.
It was the dead of night.
We didn't. Well, it was in the middle of the night, and it wouldn't have looked like much on film. We actually thought that the lights that blinked on the tower would immediately go off if it did start to fall, but as it turned out, they miraculously kept blinking for part of the fall, so I could see from my little perch up on the hill the thing crumbling in midair and still blinking as it went down. But then as the pieces started to fall and it got further and further towards the ground, the lights did go out.
Uh-huh.
And,
oh, my God.
I was a mile or two away, so I didn't hear the crash, but as Sam reports in the film, it was a loud and mighty crash.
Well, we're talking about a weather tower. We're talking with Dan Keller, a filmmaker of the movie Lovejoy's Nuclear War, about a weather tower that had been erected in Montague, Massachusetts, 90 miles west of Boston and 180 miles north of New York City, that was allegedly the precursor of a nuclear plant, nuclear power reactor, twin reactors, actually, in this small town. And, of course, Northeast Utilities had waltzed into this town thinking that they were going to have an easy time. There was a rural community. Nobody's going to fight them, and they failed to account for a number of communes in the area, including one, Montague Farm, which was a direct descendant, of course, of the old Liberation News Service, full of dangerous leftist radicals, hippies, journalists, and people who had just come to the belief that nuclear power plants should not be built. And so this act by Sam Lovejoy, which you made, Dan Keller, into a film, was the centerpiece of your film, Lovejoy's Nuclear War. Tell us about the impact. What did the impact, aside from the thing crashing to the ground, what was the political impact of what Sam did?
Well, we actually weren't planning to make a film about the tower going down originally, but as Sam's trial played out and heated up, we realized that there was a lot going on that wasn't being covered by the national media or even the local media. So Sam went on trial in Franklin County Superior Court, claiming self-defense as a motive for knocking down the tower. And among the witnesses he called were Howard Zinn, noted political historian and advocate of civil disobedience in times of dire straits, and Dr. John Goffman, who was a nuclear scientist and refugee from the Atomic Energy Commission. And both of these gentlemen came to Franklin County on their own ticket to help Sam and testify in his trial. And lo and behold, no one from the national media was really covering this.
Well, so what a surprise.
We filmed interviews with Dr. Goffman and Howard Zinn outside the courtroom, and before long we realized that this had the makings of a good documentary, so we interviewed some of the other people who testified at the trial and Sam, and put together a film which started to win a lot of prizes and really went around the world. It was shown in something like 20 or 30 countries around the world and translated into a lot of different languages. It's a 60-minute documentary, which is largely talking heads and footage from the local area and of the tower after it crashed to the ground. And the film went far and wide and received a lot of support and a lot of good reviews.
Wow, fantastic. By the way, we're at the half hour here. Deb Katz, I know you have to leave.
I do.
Thank you so much for being with us. I'll have you back continually.
Especially, have a wonderful show.
You too, and we'll especially have you on when Vermont Yankees shut,
well,
if you're sober.
We're
okay.
Really close. I can taste it. Just like I could taste it with Yankee Row, Connecticut Yankee Silkstone. We're tasting it right now.
All right, well, you keep tasting it. We'll have you back soon. We're going to take a short break, talk with Dan Keller and Anna Jones. Georgie about the transformation to Solartopia.
Oil spill meltdown, flooding suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Solartopia is home sweet home to me.
Sweet home to me. That's the wonderful, fabulous Dana Lyons, Cows with Gun Fame, singing the Rocky Top version of Solartopia. We got two guests remaining. We had a wonderful time with Deb Katz of the Citizens Awareness Network. We now have filmmaker Dan Keller talking about Lovejoy's Nuclear War, a truly amazing film about the rise of the anti-nuclear movement, and Anna Giorgi will be talking to us about the coming of Solartopia to Germany, the world's fourth largest economy, the biggest one in Europe, the transition there from nuclear power and fossil fuels to an entire industrial economy based on renewable energy. Dan Keller, just by way of disclosure, by the way, you were kind enough to list me as the co-writer of the Lovejoy's Nuclear War and also The Last Resort, so I want to thank you for that. And tell us, I think that the Lovejoy's Nuclear War actually showed on public television in Germany, is that right?
It did.
And you made this film for, about $5,000? I mean, it's not even a shoestring back in the 1970s.
Well, it was not an expensive film to produce. We did everything ourselves. We didn't collect any salaries for the work we did on it, and we had a lot of people helping us, including Anna Giorgi, who's here with us, and you, Harvey Wasserman,
yeah.
But lots of other people, too.
Yeah.
And we shot the film on used film that I had left over from a film job I was working on, and we did all the distribution ourselves.
This must have been one of the last major documentaries, or certainly the last of a generation that was made on film as opposed to video.
It was made on film, and the picture still stands up. It's a very high-quality image.
Yeah, it's amazing. So Sam Lovejoy knocked over this weather tower in Montague, Massachusetts, because we had started a movement. We coined the phrase no nukes, but we really needed some oomph there. And so you drove. I always wrote that he walked over to the tower, but you drove Sam there and then nefariously went.
Well, he was carrying a lot of heavy tools.
Uh-huh. Well,
he needed a ride.
Yeah.
But I think he did abandon the tools and then walked back and turned himself into the police, as you know.
Yes, well, now, why did he go to the road and flag down a car if you were there? Why didn't he just jump back in the car with you and have you drive?
Okay. Well, he didn't want me driving him back.
That would be conspiracy.
It would be, but it also would be a little bit more out in the open if I were actually driving him to the police station. So
yeah.
He decided that he wanted me to just drop him off and then take off.
Actually, yeah, that was a better plan, So now Sam, of course, went around speaking and still does speak, I assume, on nuclear power issues. And what has he? First of all, what happened to the nuclear plant and where they wanted to build it?
Well, they did put up another weather tower very soon after the first one went down, and they did their required 1 year of meteorological testing to see which way the wind blows. And then they shortly thereafter decided that they didn't want to build the plant and
right.
made an announcement to that effect saying that it was for economic reasons. But I think everyone in the local area and involved in the fight to stop it knew very well that Sam had mobilized public opinion in the cause of stopping the plant, and if they were going to try to actually build the thing there, they were going to face some serious resistance.
Now, there's a rumor, some people call it an urban legend or a rural legend in this case, that the somebody from the utility company wrote Sam a letter many years later thanking him for helping stop the reactor because it would have bankrupted the company. Is that true?
I don't know anything about that.
Okay. Anna, do you know Anna Georgie? You know anything about
no,
that?
No, can't help you there.
All right. Well, we will track that down. So, Dan, the nuclear plant was never built. Is that correct?
That's right.
And what happened to the site, the proposed site?
Well, I think the proposed site was largely turned into conservation land, as far as I know.
I think, and didn't Sam have a hand in doing that? What's happened with Sam Lovejoy now? What does he do?
Well, he graduated to another profession. He now works for the state of Massachusetts doing mainly land conservation.
So he saves environmentally sensitive pieces of land.
That's what his main job is now, right?
Fantastic. And he got through law school, right? They put him, despite this, he was never convicted of anything. Isn't that correct?
Well, right. He was actually, the judge ended up directing the verdict because the charge was inadequate and inaccurate. He was charged with destroying real property, and it turned out to be personal property. And so the judge was able to direct the verdict and find Sam not guilty. But we did interview some of the jurors after the trial, and everyone we talked to said that the jury was on the verge of letting him go because they thought that he did actually act in self-defense.
Fantastic. And I want to point out, by the way, you mentioned that Howard Zinn, the great historian who has since passed away, did come on his own steam from Boston to testify. And I want to thank Howard again, he's not with us anymore, a wonderful man, wrote an introduction to My History of the United States, which is the reason it got published. Thank you again, Howard. And John Goffman, who was the original chief health official of the Atomic Energy Commission and a tremendously important scientist whose discoveries actually facilitated the rise of nuclear power, flew himself all the way from California to come testify in this tiny town in western Massachusetts. John Goffman was a world-class scientist, actually discovered LDL cholesterol, among other things. And he, of course, is in your film, Lovejoy's Nuclear War. Available from where, Dan, if you'll tell us again?
GMP Films, as in Green Mountain Post, so gmpfilms.com.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Dan Keller. I hope you stay
My
with
pleasure.
Us. I want to talk now with Anna Georgie. Anna, are you talking to us from Bonn?
No, I'll be there pretty soon.
Okay,
but,
so you have spent much of your last decade or two in Germany. You were, again, with us at Montague Farm, present at the creation of the No Nukes movement, that phrase being coined in a tiny little room in the upper right-hand corner of the farmhouse at Montague Farm. And you then put together with, as you say, 52 people, the anthology No Nukes. But you are now witnessing firsthand the transition on this second anniversary of Fukushima of the whole country of Germany from fossil and nuclear power to solartopian technologies. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I'm really happy to, because I've been so impressed when coming back here, how people know about Germany and say, you know, oh, Germany's doing it right and the big change is happening in Germany, as if somehow the German government suddenly realized, you know, that this was the way to go. And in fact, it's the result of an incredible popular movement, social movement, both against nuclear power and for solar and renewable energy. And these movements have been parallel and mutually supportive, but usually different people, different groups, networks. The anti-nuclear movement started in Germany around the same time it's here, the activist anti-nuclear movement, and had just a whole series of demonstrations and fights. There are 17 nuclear plants in Germany. Germany is about the size of California and much more heavily populated than the U.S., so these plants are right near cities and right on major rivers, so they pose a really special danger. And the change after Fukushima, first of all, in 1986, the Chernobyl catastrophe affected Germany tremendously, and that really turned the population at the time against nuclear power. And it was an instant kind of education, because it was spring, the first salad was coming up, and kids were happy to play outside, and suddenly, not suddenly, several days after it actually happened, because from the Russian and also French side, they were saying, oh, the radiation is staying where it is, you know, no problem. But people realized they were affected. And so that's a major shock that now it really alerted people and made it very personal. So there was already this huge movement against nuclear power that resulted in 2000 in a nuclear phase out by the year 2022, which was not supported by the anti-nuclear movement. The people who live near these plants, they said, shut them down now. We've got to move now towards renewables and efficiency. But there was a phase out. So anyway, there was already a very slow phase out happening. And a year before Fukushima, the government that is now still in power pushed for an extension of these nukes. So it was government policy to increase the lifespan of these nukes. But when Fukushima happened, it was all over.
Well, tell us about that. My understanding is that the anti-nuclear movement had called for a major national demonstration before Fukushima happened, on a date that was to be after Fukushima happened.
Well, it was pretty surreal, because they have a whole calendar there, and they're very well organized with kind of the backbone of the local folks and then groups in many, many cities. And on March 12th, 2 years ago, there was plans for calling for around 40,000 people to form a human chain from the oldest plant to one of the waste dumps. And in Bonn, we had a practice for it. I mean, it was really great. There was a lot of spirit, and people took train. Everybody was assigned to their different part of the chain. And the head of the Bonn delegation told us when he got out of the train, there was the news that Fukushima had happened. So suddenly there were 60,000 people on this human chain. And the media was like, oh, boy, they were out there reacting. But in fact, it had been planned for a long time. But Fukushima on Saturday, well, it started last week, 30,000 people demonstrated in really lousy weather, making a chain, kind of a symbolic chain, around the uranium, the fuel rod fabrication plant in Gronau, which is north of Bonn, where I also live, which is just a kind of a boxy factory. I was there for the Fukushima demo last year, right outside of town, with just some chain link fences and guards. You wouldn't realize that what high level, you know, import fuel rods are being made there, and waste and all that. And so people, instead of going directly to the plant, most people went to cities surrounding it in like a 300-mile radius representing the evacuation zone of Fukushima. So there's terrific pictures, and just there's always a lot of high spirit and a lot of young people. It's three generations now that have been opposing nuclear power in Germany.
Wow.
And they were passing out iodine pills and have all these alert signs and ribbons saying a closed area because of nuclear meltdown. So they really know how to do it and get the word out. And then today, there were, just to finish there on the Fukushima anniversary, today in 201 cities, 8,700 people held vigils. So virtually all over the country.
So tell us now exactly what is happening in Germany on the ground in terms of the transition that's very clearly being made. And I want to say that my impression of this, and maybe in comment, is the commitment to get out of nuclear and to go to renewables could not have been made without the cooperation of at least some of the major corporations in Germany. But if you'll tell us, please, what exactly is happening on the ground with the energy system in Germany?
Well, after Fukushima, the government was pretty much forced to shut the oldest nuke. So they shut 8 out of 17, and they are not going to reopen. They're too old. And the corporations were screaming and yelling and demanding compensation. And so the big fight now, and what I think people don't really, well, they don't understand because the American media doesn't cover it, but they're an energy change or an energy transformation can be defined in many ways. And the big fight now is, what's it going to look like? And the corporate image is centralized, big offshore wind plants, which cost a lot of money and are really quite technologically, you know, hard to build and have all kinds of ecological repercussions in the ocean too. And then a huge, what the opponents call an electricity highway. So huge high power lines from the North Sea all the way through Germany to bring the electricity to the south. So that's the government plan, and they're putting in lots of money into this. The opponents, I mean, the solar movement says, we don't need any of this. We're doing it already, because there's already been, even in the first 6 months of last year, the amount of electricity produced with renewable energy in Germany rose from 20% to 25%. So they're already really on the way, and their targets by 2020 will probably be much higher than the 35% they want, and by 2050 it could be 100%. And so the question is, are we going to do it sooner and decentralized under local control, or are we going to let the big companies subsidized by the government bring us this so-called energy change with continued natural gas and coal?
Now, I've read that it's actually, despite the best efforts or the worst efforts of the large corporations there, that it's actually becoming much more decentralized than they had originally thought, just even in the first year.
It is. It is. Now, that's what's so amazing. It's happening, you know. But there's subsidies. I mean, when government, as you well know, nuclear power wouldn't exist without huge government subsidies. And that is, unfortunately, still the power of the government in charge to subsidize centralized as opposed to decentralized. So that's the big fight now, and it's really interesting, and there's a lot of, and important, and a lot of communities are kind of voting with their feet. You know, they're working on it on the local level.
Well, what form does it take? Are we talking about solar panels, windmills, biofuels, all the above? What's happening?
Well, unlike the Obama, all of the above, the first thing to know is that Germany, which is highly industrialized, uses per head, half. I'm not used to speaking English. Do you believe that? They use half, 50% of the energy of one American. So they're starting already with... they can still reduce a lot, but they're starting, you know, without this unbelievable waste that is present in the United States, which is a sign to us that we can, you know, so much can be should be done here before we even start about talking about building new energy sources. The first thing is efficiency and conservation. So anyway, they've had an energy efficiency law, a renewable energy law for about 10 years that has subsidized people who put solar panels on their roofs, and it guarantees them a certain amount for every kilowatt that's produced. And that has just had a tremendous effect. So you just see these roofs and roofs of barn and out on the side, and it and then people who don't have a solar solar, you know,
facing windows, south-facing.
Right, a solar exposure, I think they call it. Right. They can group together in groups of 8 to a couple hundred and invest in a solar mini farm in some farmer's field or you know, someplace even in southern Germany. So there's a whole little industry of direct investment in wind and solar, but decentralized and local. Because the key to renewables, as you well know, is first cut the energy use, and then make the energy close to where you're going to use it so you don't lose it in transmission, and you have more control over it.
Well, and how do what's the public sentiment about all this? I mean, you know, here in the United States, we have ferocious Koch brothers-funded resistance to windmills and solar panels and all that stuff, which is almost incomprehensible to me, but nonetheless, it goes on. And I mean, do you see this in Germany? How is the public reacting?
Not at all. There's no question about climate change. It's really a question of how soon, how far. The coal industry is a big lobby. There's still there are even coal plants being built as bridge technology. So the fight, you know, and the struggles are around how soon and what form of how soon can we move to renewables, and also a real race to find storage, because that's a key problem.
Well, you mean energy storage?
For wind and solar, because, you know, the wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine. So
right.
There's annual conferences that bring together all kinds of experts on different forms of storage and stuff. So the issue has totally shifted. There's absolutely, I mean, here it's like dinosaur land, and so dangerous and so awful that climate change, the existence of climate change, is even an issue, because it definitely isn't there. And the corporations are so kind of in the corner. And one reason they're in the corner is that people are allowed to switch from the big companies, the big electric companies, to local providers of green energy. So that you can just switch to companies, and there are many of them, that get their that group together electricity from small dams and solar, and act as merchants for this alternative energy. And the more people who do that, the less power the corporations have, the less income they have from their atomic energy, and they're feeling it.
Wow, that's really interesting. I want you, if you'll indulge me, there is a German word that's used to talk about this transition. Can you say it in German?
Yeah, Energiewende. And it means
Energiewende.
Energie is energy.
Oh, energy. Oh, okay.
And Wende is like transformation or turn or shift or change. And Wende, just a little history, when the wall came down in Berlin, you know, in Germany, and there was no GDR anymore, no East Germany, that was called the Wende, the turn. It's almost like a U-turn, you know,
uh-huh.
The change. So this change is as big in a way, it's really big, because it defines how you want to live, you know, what kind of control communities are going to have. There are programs in schools, local level, municipalities are working on this. So that the whole discussion is a completely, it's I mean, the discussion that goes on here is not even, you know, that was decided long ago. I mean, there was a devastating a drought in 2003 where 15,000 French people died, mostly the elderly. It was in August, and all Paris goes on vacation, and they left some of the, you know, the grandparents who didn't want to come or whatever, and it was just unbelievable. 15,000 people died, and it was an incredible heat wave, and we've had those often in Germany, which is not really doesn't really have, you know, desert type climate. And there's been a terrible flooding where there's a whole thing about rivers restoring riverbanks so that they can overflow naturally, so that there's really
Anna.
Yep.
We're at the end of the show. It's been wonderful talking to you.
Thank you.
By the way, there is an American term for the new law there. It's called a feed-in tariff. We've been talking with Anna Giorgi about the transition in Germany to solartopian energy. Thank you so much, Anna. With Dan Keller, a maker of many films, including Lovejoy's Nuclear War, previously with Deb Katz. On this anniversary of Fukushima, I hope we put some joy and light in your life. Next week, we will talk about industrial hemp, too high to fail. Thank you so much. Go out and stop the rest of this nuclear industry. We got to get to Solartopia at least by next week. Thank you so much, and we'll be back again at the Solartopia Green Power.